According to an article that I came across in the Weekend Australian a few months back, record numbers of young men are rushing to get the big V. I'm not talking about vaccination. I'm talking about vasectomies, and right away you've just gone, you've ruined Christmas for us. Thanks, mate. But stick with me, I haven't lost my mind. It's not blokes with, you know, five kids and a thousand-yard stare that are getting it done. It's young, childless men. Dr. Justin Lowe, a SNP doctor in Sydney who does 50 vasectomies a week, imagine that, says half of them are childless men who are much, much younger than in years gone past. And you've got to ask, well, why is that? Well, Dr. Lowe, as he's counselling these young men, sort of saying, are you sure you want to do this? He hears a recurring theme, and a guy like Michael, probably not his real name, articulates it. He says, the biggest reason is just a pretty negative outlook for the future. I'm not happy about having that view. I look at optimists and I really envy them. But I just see mounting problems in the world and a lack of action and solutions. With the challenges I'm betting humanity will face, the fact is it's just not something I'm happy to impose on a child. The world's hopeless. Why would you dump all that hopelessness on a baby? It's a bad pun, but hope's been snipped off. Michael and thousands like him, when you see the statistics, they just see mounting problems. They see climate change, they see sustainability issues, they see the warfare, the massive political upheaval. Why dump all that hopelessness on a baby? Now, I don't know about you, I find that all a bit sad. Hope is really an essential ingredient to live, and we'll come back to this later. But how might that change? Actually, how does Christmas give us any kind of hope? We've already thought about it a bit in the kids' talk, but we need to think a bit more about the hopelessness and the pessimism that guys like Michael have and where that comes from. You know, Michael might point to the trouble in our world and say, oh, well, that's it. But there's two things. His vision, perhaps, of what it might take to fix things is too small when you read the article. He's missing what's underneath all the mess. Like, if you're going to save the world, Michael says you need action. You need people to do stuff. You need to take action on the climate. You need to come up with some solutions to poverty. You need better politicians, and on it goes. And it is a vision of a world that would be better and I would like. But why do we have problems with our environment? Why do we have political upheaval and wars that never seem to go away? Why is it we can't get politicians that are driven by civic duty rather than self-interest? I mean, even our attempts often to fix things go awry. I think of Michael. His solution is stop having kids. Just think about where that's going to get you all in about 30 to 40 years' time. A lot of lonely people in aged care facilities with no one looking after them. There's a deeper problem, isn't there, really? At the heart of the matter, the hopelessness of our world is driven by us trying to make the world better without the God who made it and made us. Like, think again of the big sweep of the Bible. God initially commands the first parents to fill the earth, to multiply, to steward it, but they choose to ignore him, thinking they know better, and the rest is, as they say, history. And that attitude, that posture towards God, as the Bible diagnoses it, is sin. Look, Michael is sliding into hopelessness because he's settling for a small version of salvation. Let's just fix the immediate presenting problems. And he's got no hope that anyone can do anything about that. He's missing the heart of the problem. To restore hope, to start with, you need to recognise how much bigger the problem really is. We need something deeper done in people at the heart, at the spiritual level. And a man like Simeon, who we read about a moment ago, he understands that. Young guys are giving up hope. He's an old fella and he's totally got hope. In verse 25, we read he's waiting for, you could say he's hoping for, the consolation of Israel. That word consolation is so important. In his day, Israel was a pretty dark place politically and socially and spiritually. Simeon is waiting for an Old Testament idea that the prophet Isaiah spoke about, that comfort, consolation, they're interchangeable words. Deep consolation and peace that comes from having sin, as Isaiah spoke about, forgiven. The deep spiritual fracture between us and God healed. Sin leads to incredible discomfort and despair now, and death and dissolution forever. But God promises to do something about that, to deal with sin. But is it just a promise? I mean, is Simeon just a silly old man? Is there any solid reason for hope? Well, this is the kind of woohoo dramatic irony in my Christmas talk. Men in droves are getting rid of having babies because it's all hopeless. It's a baby boy who gives you hope. In verse 26 of the passage we read, you know, God has shown Simeon with his own eyes he'll see the Lord's Messiah, the King who will save Israel. They hoped for him to do that. The scriptures foretold would deal with sin. He'd bring that comfort and consolation. But just in your mind's eye, imagine the scene in the temple a bit for the moment this morning. There's Joseph, a slightly awkward older bloke, and his now teenage kind of wife, and a little baby who's just been born in a stable out the back of a hoey moey in Bethlehem. And they've come to the temple to do the things that devout Jewish parents do with a firstborn son, and they are dirt poor. The sacrifices they offer are for the people who've got nothing. This is a pretty hopeless-looking situation. But Simeon takes this baby in his arms in verse 28 and sings, probably, "Sovereign Lord, as you've promised, you may now dismiss your servant in peace, for my eyes have seen your salvation." Picking up a baby and saying, "I've seen salvation." I mean, like I said to the kids, if you've had a baby, you know that they can be pretty hopeless. Utterly dependent, utterly weak. They can't even put themselves to sleep, let alone fix the problems of the world. But just think it through a bit more. This is the way God comes into the world. God's King and Messiah doesn't come fully grown, you know, sort of teleported back from some future time to do his job. He doesn't come like a politician, sort of spruiking great promises and then back to an air-conditioned office in Canberra. He doesn't come with an army. He doesn't come as a fully credentialed expert who will sit up and take notice of. This tips us off to the way God might be working in all of this to restore hope. Babies are not the usual solution to world crises. This is unusual stuff. And Simeon says something ominous about the future of this baby that foreshadows how he'll do the work of bringing hope. In verse 34, he said to Mary, "This child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel and to be a sign that will be spoken against, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed and a sword will pierce your own soul too." Right at the start, in the midst of this really already desperate-looking situation for this little family, there's going to be incredible grief. Whatever Simeon's got in mind exactly, the way Jesus will bring comfort, consolation, it's going to come the hard way. And come the hard way it does. You see it in the rest of Luke's gospel. God's salvation, born in Bethlehem, finds himself hanging on a Roman cross because people spoke against him, as Simeon says. And just like a baby is a strange way to fix things, so is a cross. You know, Michael says, who would want to impose all the hopelessness of the world on their child? God does. And God the Son endures it willingly. In a way we really struggle to fathom, it's at the cross where Jesus has the hopelessness of our world because of our sin laid on him. He takes the penalty of our rejection of God's way at the cross. The hopeless future into eternity that people face is borne by Jesus instead of you. And look, the hopes of Simeon and others might have looked dashed at the cross, but Luke tells us, of course, that Jesus rises. Simeon can say, "I have seen God's salvation," as he holds a baby boy who deals with sin, who rises again to defeat death, which is the great killer of hope for all of us. That's what fixes the world in a bigger way, spiritually, but it does more. I want to finish by asking folks, are you hopeless or hopeful people? And I want you to walk out of here today being hopeful. And you think, how? Well, again, go back to Simeon's words that Jesus would, in a sense, divide people. Some will fall over him, some will rise. There's hearts that are going to be revealed as perhaps being too proud for Jesus. They just cannot see a king who saves them, who can actually restore this world in a bigger way than we can even imagine. But of course, there are hearts that are humble and realise they need a saviour. If you want hope, a hope for a better world, that death isn't the final word, ironically, it means giving up hope. Giving up hope that you and us on our own bat can fix this place. Like Simeon, you need to grab hold of Jesus and say, here's God's salvation. And that does something now. You see, being hopeful doesn't mean just waiting around to die and go to heaven while the world goes to slop. I was reading in a recent piece in the ABC, Stan Grant writing and lamenting the erosion of faith, especially the Christian faith that he grew up with uncles and aunts who were pastors in the Aboriginal church years ago, and he muses about what the loss of faith has done, particularly in the West. He says, what are we left with? A society obsessed with cartoonish cancel culture, debilitating contests for recognition and poisonous identity wars. And he goes on, he says, there's little transcendence, inherent pessimism, and hopelessness. And he talks about what it's done to him. He says, my Christmases are sadder now that my grandparents, uncles and aunties are gone. Our world is immeasurably poorer for the loss and derision of faith and the substitute of cynicism. I want to reach out to Stan and say to him, mate, it doesn't have to be sadder. Just like look back at your aunties and uncles for crying out loud. Like Simeon, they grabbed hold of Jesus. Believing that your sin is forgiven and that Jesus has conquered death and is going to restore this world changes your heart so that you can't, even if you're a melancholic fellow like me, you can't be cynical. You can't be hopeless. It's why Stan's aunties and uncles fought for equality years and years ago. It's why actually people still do have children, because existence is better than not existing. It means we should encourage each other to be careful with the resources that we've got and call out each other's greed. It means that we should call on politicians to care. And of course it means that we should share this hope with others because they might believe too. They might find a hope that lets them live. That's what we get at Christmas. We're going to pray in a moment, but before we do, let's sing again of how the hopes and fears of God's people are met in Jesus. Our hopes of a Messiah and a Saviour are fulfilled. Fears about our future are relieved. And it's for meek souls who receive him still. Let's stand together and sing, O Little Town of Bethlehem.